Hi, my name is Scott.
And I am Zach.
Welcome to Learning Grounds.
Episode 3. It is a podcast that is one conversation, one cup of coffee long.
Today we talk with Vanessa and Paul.
About universal design for learning, open source.
Zeega.
Z-E-E-G-A .org. And a bunch of other stuff, really.
So yeah.
You're going to love what you're about to hear. We should say that at some point in the podcast, Vanessa says 3,000 classrooms.
That was wrong.
That was so wrong.
Very wrong.
But we love her just the same.
We really do.
That number should have been 2,000 classrooms. You're not going to understand this now, but believe us, you'll get it a little bit later on.
It'll be great.
Yes. So without further ado, welcome to Learning Grounds, Episode 3.
Hi there, and welcome to Episode 3 of Learning Grounds.
Hi.
I'm Zach.
I'm Scott.
And with us today, we have Vanessa.
Vanessa!
And lurking in the background, literally lurking. I mean, you're actually physically farther away from us.
What is the physical definition of to lurk?
If he was behind a shrubbery, he'd be lurking.
Right, mm-hmm. So we could just kind of...
Now he's behind a chair. It works
behind
out.
Behind a chair.
Is Paul. Hi, Paul.
Behind a chair.
Hello.
Probably can't hear him as well with the microphone. It's possible.
It's okay.
It's all right.
So...
Zach, what are you drinking today?
Shockingly, I am drinking a blonde.
Yeah.
A grande blonde. In my cup... I should get a cup for you.
I should have a cup. You shouldn't get a cup for
you. You should just have a cup.
I should have a cup.
And then, yeah. So you aren't trashing the environment. So what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a, I assume, medium roast drip coffee with 2 shots of hazelnut and cream.
That's correct. Vanessa?
I am drinking a chai.
Chai seems like a popular beverage.
Chai was last week's guest.
Yeah.
Paul, what are you drinking?
A cup of coffee.
Not scotch. let's get into it. I started recording while you were in the middle of a conversation about universal design for learning.
Oh, God, that was recorded.
Just the end part. Right before I said hi. And someone's at the door.
That's Chris.
That's Chris. He's in my class.
Hi, Chris.
How's it going, guys?
Hey, Chris. Welcome to our podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Turned on the recording light.
Good job, Scott. So Vanessa and I went to this thing this afternoon, mm-hmm. And Paul was there as well, for this thing called Zeega.
Yes.
Zeega.org.
HTML5.
Yeah, built on HTML5, which I'm learning about, which seems like the coding language I would prefer to learn if I were going to learn to do anything on the internet.
You know how to do things on the internet, Zach.
I do, but if I wanted to build things.
Point and click.
Yeah, I know I can point and click. You can use the internet.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is, so it's all about storytelling, and the idea is archiving and storytelling and creating interesting kind of presentations using this platform. I started having all these ideas of like, where would I use this and where should it live? What did you think?
Well, what I gathered, I was half an hour late. What I gathered is that the way that most people have used it is embedding data in layers. So we saw maps, we saw a lot of demographic data, and the way that I thought about it is just a platform that enables mashups.
Okay, that's interesting.
So
I think, like, kind of to give some context for those listeners who may not know.
There you go, assuming listeners again, Scott.
About anything, right, besides our mothers. That was a mistake. But my mother doesn't know anything about HTML.
Okay, good save.
Or HTML5, or CSS, or CSS3, or CSS2, for that matter. So, for a little context...
I don't either, by the way.
Right. So, for a little context, for any listener who happens to either be in the room or
context,
not...
Context, that's UDL.
That's right. By the way, the Media Lab is closed, technically. So, they were like, we'll open the door for you, but don't let anybody in.
Don't ruin anything.
Right. So, don't ruin anything. I guess. anyways, so HTML is essentially a plain text markup language that is used by the internet in the grand scheme to read what information is presented on web pages. CSS is the style sheet that dictates how that information will look on the internet when you open it up in a web browser. If you open it up in an HTML editor, or if you open it up a source code, it looks quite a bit different, just a bunch of lines of code. HTML5, which is what Ziga is built on, is the most recent version put out by the W3, which stands for...
Whoa.
People have nothing better to do.
Recent version of HTML.
And bless them for not having anything better to do.
Because they make stuff like this.
Standards.
Standards for us to go by.
Standards.
They're like
based
the APA
creation.
And the MLA and all those.
So that's an interesting introduction and like context building.
Yeah.
And it was interesting sitting and listening to this presentation because they did a demo, mm-hmm. And we were late too, mainly because the room got changed and we didn't know. So we missed most of the demo.
Yeah.
But
coding or whatever.
Missed the demo of the Ziga being used. We came in at the very tail end of it. And then they moved into code. And what was really interesting for me is someone who doesn't work in the land of the things that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. was this kind of immersion in the language. Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the things I said to Paul was, okay, I feel this is what it feels like to be in an immersion classroom. Because they were saying all these things that sounded like things that I knew about because the language is based on English, right? And like they appropriated all these other words. And so I think it's really fascinating, and it got me thinking of like, how am I learning in this moment? And what is it? Because I really wanted to understand. And so Paul and I were texting back and forth kind of saying, I said, I think I understand the basics of what's going on here, but not mm-hmm. the details, right? And this is language acquisition, mm-hmm. right? I got the cultural vocabulary, but not the academic. And all of that was happening. And it was really interesting to see. Now, Vanessa, where do you work, Vanessa? Do you have a job?
I have a job. I am an acquisitions editor for Flat World Knowledge, which is the open source textbook publisher. Mm-hmm. And I also facilitate courses for peer-to-peer university. And I'm also a research assistant for Scratch over at MIT.
So
nice.
So you live a little
so
bit
you
more
really
in the
just,
world.
You just don't do anything at all.
Yeah.
I'm a huge slacker.
Right.
And she goes to school.
Yeah.
So you said, like on the walk back over here, you said that you didn't really, like the code wasn't kind of your bag as much either.
Well, not that it wasn't my bag, but... you know, it's less effective. Actually, what that talk taught me most about was how to apply learning sciences to walk people through how something works. Because what they did is they just projected the code on the screen. And for people who know what that does, mm-hmm. like, okay, totally transparent. But for someone who doesn't know what that does, that's a less effective learning experience for you than just being able to, like, you know, if you can see it work. Like, let's say they made the variable. Let's say they coded it on the fly. Like, then you could see how all those parts fit together. But just projecting it on the screen...
And it was, it was a keynote presentation.
Right.
So it was just a slide deck with the information.
With the information.
And some things flew in and labeled what was going on.
So this is a really interesting observation of audience, right? Because this meeting happened at the design school. Right.
Actually, well, it was based in the design school.
Based in the design school.
The building ended up being at the law school.
Mm. And the parent organization through which it seems like Ziga is run is like the Media Lab.
It's the Meta Lab.
Meta Lab, that's mm-hmm. what I meant.
The Meta Lab, the design school, the Knight Foundation, the Berkman Institute are all tied to this project.
And so
The Berkman Institute is the Berkman Institute for the Internet and Society.
When I heard about this from Zach... I immediately went onto the interwebs and started to look at it, having no idea what it was. And then I called my design school friends.
Looked at Ziga and see what it was?
I looked at Ziga, and then I went through and, you know, I was pointing and clicking using my expansive internet skills.
Well done.
Through that, I got into some of the, you know, just got onto some of the other sites. MetaLab is one of them. the one that I recall the most. And then I immediately went to my design school friends. I said, tell me what you know about MetaLab and Zigo or any of that stuff. And what was interesting to me was that my design, I have several people I'm close to who are at the design school who I know through living with them, and none of them really knew much about it. If you asked any of these people, though, about HTML or CSS or any of these coding languages that are used for the internet, they have a working knowledge.
Well, I don't think, though, that the MetaLab is designed around the idea of coding.
Clearly
or
not.
Or design.
Clearly not.
Like, I think it is more, in the space that I occupy once a week, twice a week there, it's about talking about the humanities and how those are influenced by kind of the times in which we live and the way the digital humanities can kind of play. And we won't be defining digital humanities because, as we've learned over the last 3 weeks, there's no clear definition of digital humanities. Oh, Paul wants to say something.
Paul wants to push at that a little.
The class that we're in is about digital humanities. It's about bringing humanists into the MetaLab.
Right.
So I don't think...
What's the title of that course?
It's called Digital Humanities 2.0/XP Crit.
Facilitated by whom?
Exactly.
Nice. Oh. Not for nothing, but we will do the jokes. Huh. No, I'm just kidding.
If I can, I want to revisit why we think it's so nebulous. Like, Zach and I went to this presentation, and we have, like, only a fleeting sort of understanding.
Right.
And you ask MetaLab, like, why... Can we unpack why we think that's so vague?
Well,
why we think what's so vague?
What Zigo is, or what the MetaLab is, or, like...
I think because there's an assumption, and this gets into sort of the UDL, we have or particularly something that I was talking about in Tina Grosser's class, the title of which I forget, but it's T543 is the course number.
Applying cognitive science in the classroom.
To learning and teaching or something like that, right? Yeah. We were talking very much about the assumptions that you make about your learners, or the assumptions you make about a group of learners, or the assumptions you make about the learning process, and how, I mean, we were looking at it through the lens of culture in particular, but how that affects the way that you teach. So, for instance, an example of this might be, if your entire audience is an audience of web developers, or web designers who are well-versed in these languages, we'll just say web designers, because web designers use HTML and CSS as their bread and butter. If your entire audience is those people, then that coding piece of the HTML5 platform should theoretically be something that they're fluent in, therefore they understand it. It's not nebulous at all. It's not vague at all.
So you're saying the assumption was that, like, the three of us weren't going to show up today?
Yes.
But even so, I've actually seen really compelling demos that are coded on the fly, and it shows not only how easy they are to use, but it walks the users through the steps that actually a maker takes to do them.
Right.
So I actually thought it wasn't, like, I wasn't as invited into the making process by the design of this lecture. If I were to redesign it myself, I would have, you know, put three or four people around one machine and said, use it to make something together. Because what they ultimately wanted from us was help creating content around their platform. They've kind of created something that they're like, we don't really know what to do with it next. And that's why that goes to, like, the nebulous question, is they, like, they need some help in direction. They said it was going to be project driven. So it was going to go from project to project. That was going to drive the development agenda. So if that was their outcome, if they wanted people to develop content and they wanted people to understand it, why weren't we makers with them in that moment?
Huh. Paul? Paul, you're going to need to come closer.
We can barely hear you. We hear the sound of your lurking more than the sound of your voice.
I think that the one project that they do have that's going is this, which they mentioned sort of obliquely at the end of the thing, is this Japan project, Which is, because a lot of what they're doing is based on this idea of, like, aggregating massive amounts of data. So they have this project that they're working on around the tsunami, where they're going to collect, like, tweets and Facebook postings and photos and video and all kinds of media available on the web in the time right before, after, and surrounding the tsunami, and sort of bring it into this, like, media aggregator. And
so is the idea then that people will see, like, all this media will be in kind of a collection or a library, and that you can go in and build the stories out using those collections, so that anybody could do that? Or
that's my sense, yeah.
That's really interesting. So it's and what's also interesting here is that, like, the idea of, because I'm totally okay with them saying to us, you know, we don't know what we're going to do, what this is for. We built this cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Would you come play with it? And I think that's really interesting. And so that the criticism, it sounds like, is not that it's open and they built something that has no clear purpose, but that they didn't invite us to play with it in that moment.
Right.
Is that...
That was a question for you.
No, it was just an open question.
That would be what I would say. And actually, you know, during the conversation part, I actually, or the question answer part, I kind of felt like it edged towards that. Like, there was kind of like, there was an invitation from them, the developers, what do you guys want to make? Like, there are a lot of smart people in this room. Let's do it together. If I had my druthers, that just would have moved up faster.
It would have been like, here's the thing, here's the language, here's the wiki where we have all our documentation.
We have a lot of differing and
they have all
diverse,
that stuff,
yeah.
Correct?
Right, all that's... Yeah.
I mean, the deal is, and I imagine this is the case, so a variety of different professional objectives are being, it seems, in my limited exposure to this project, accomplished via this platform by a variety of different kind of sort of professional objectives by different professional types, because there was one that they've done some work with NPR, right, on Main Street, U.S. something documenting Main Streets in America.
Right, a really cool piece that's like kind of pictures from Main Streets across the country. And
right, and it's a database of all these different ones, and some of them have interviews with business people whose business takes place on the Main Streets, various Main Streets in America. And then there was another that I looked at that was far smaller in scale, kind of geographically, but it was a history of the women's bathing suit.
That's interesting.
I did not see
in
that.
In America, right? And sort of so there's a lot of just sort of different objectives that are being, that people are trying to accomplish, and they're putting it out there into the world to see what becomes of it, it seems right? But the barrier of using this platform to build this thing is clearly usability because it's embedded in coding, right?
Well, no. They were showing the coding for, like, because this was an alpha launch, and so what they were saying was now our API, the structure, the skeleton of this app is now available because it's all open source. So it's not a coding-based thing. But if you wanted to host it on your site, then you would need to know how to make it talk to other services, right? So if they've said, we've got it talking to SoundCloud, we've got it talking to Flickr, so it's already working. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a buggy edition because it's still
it's
an alpha.
Yeah.
So the barrier is not that. It's just kind of like, we've got this thing, we need people to start using it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, today, the presentation was an interesting sort of crash course in how open source works. Like, sort of the invitation to users to make it what you want it to be. And actually, a really great moment happened where someone asked, is this on GitHub? And someone in the audience said, yeah, I've already forked it.
And I looked up what forked meant. Because Urban Dictionary tells you something filthy. But Wikipedia tells you something not filthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you brought that up. Can I take this a different place? So, to and you'll help me here because you live in this world more than I do, but like to fork something means to kind of take the open source code and put it, do your install and start tinkering and building what you want and what you want it to become based on the kind of platform that's been given to you, right? And then you push it back out and say, here's what I built with it, and other people can then fork it again. And so it's like, it's literally like the forking of branches in a tree.
That is how I... exactly true.
Okay. So it started...
Thanks for
Zach. Yay! That's me. That's what I'm learning. What was interesting to me is thinking about applying that model to the classroom. And talking to kids and like, so let's say we're still standards based, right? We've still got like, these are the things you need to teach. But we say, here's the thing, like here's the standard to the kid. What do you think you could build around this, right? Figure this out. And then they take that and they say, maybe it's a paper, right? Maybe they're like, or a website, or it's a presentation or a play. It doesn't have to be technological. And then they say, they get it to that kind of nascent stage, mm-hmm. and maybe they're responsible for that standard, and they take it to the rest of the class and say, here's what we've created at this point. You can either help us build what we've started, or you can take this, and like the idea of forking happens in the class, and so you take that, the first bit of that play, and maybe you say, I want to do this, and I want to make it into a song, right? Or I want to build that website that you didn't build. And what would the implications be there?
At its core, these gestures, or this gesture, is about two things, right? It's about sharing, and about differing levels of expertise, and that you've taken a project as far as you can go, or as far as you're interested in taking it, and then you give it back to someone who can take it further. I can't speak to the classroom, but
you can speak to learning.
What program are you in, Vanessa? We didn't even cover.
Oh,
what program
I am in TIE.
Which stands
Technology,
for?
Innovation, and Education Program.
I like that you guys got innovation, and that all the other programs are like, we don't have to innovate.
We don't really innovate. We just hang out.
We're free. but you design, like, there's textbook design, right?
Yes.
And so you're involved in that. So you're talking about that learning, like, that kind of...
In response to Nimbus, right?
To Nimbus?
I don't know what you're talking about.
So, Nimbus... if I'm pronouncing it, remembering the letters correctly, it's the legal code that mandates that all textbooks published after a certain date in the United States be digitized in addition to...
it's NIMAS.
NIMAS, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
N-I-M-A-S.
That's right.
We should just have Paul around every week.
We really should. Just
sit at the computer.
Fact checker, yeah. And be like, and this is why you're wrong. You know, that kind
of... That's off the top of my head. I'm not looking.
Oh!
Yeah. That's right.
You're quite the show off.
Thank you. So I assume, I could be wrong, but a significant amount of this work is in response to this legal code that says that all new textbook materials must be digitized. Such that they can be accessible for purposes of UDL and things of that nature in addition to other services. Is that not correct?
Well, Flatworld's about being able to produce multiple versions so that the student chooses which version they want to consume.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a PDF available, or it's free to view in a browser, or you can buy the audiobook or a print-on-demand version. So it's actually about student choice.
So how do you do, like, what would this look like in kind of textbook design? Does that make sense?
Sure, I
feel like I'm asking the most kind of amorphous question ever, but you get what I'm saying, let's just go.
Okay, let's refine it. Let's talk about textbook content as foundational content.
Okay.
Like, as completely sort of, you know, vanilla, like the
textbooks we probably had when we were in school.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I kind of conceive of Flatworld's job as creating that foundational content that's the consensus view in the field.
Okay.
And then, so that would be the core code that's committed in this analogy.
Oh, I like what you've done there.
And and
we are nerding out.
And then other users who perhaps want to take their U.S. history book in a more political direction, mm-hmm. or want to take their
say the state of Texas,
for instance. They would in the Flat World model submit a pull request, pull the book, adapt it, and then share it back.
Who would be responsible? And you would be responsible for that adaptation?
The users would.
So I'm the state of Zach.
Uh-huh.
And I say, I want my... That's awesome. I've always thought about world domination, but just getting my own state.
Your own state would be nice. Capital city.
So I say, you know what? In my version of American history textbook, I want to make sure that we give at least 50% footing to traditionally underrepresented populations, right? So I would then pull the text that mm-hmm. you've created, and I would go through and I would try to balance, and I have no idea what...
Yeah, the definition of 50% is,
I don't know how, yeah, but that, like, this is the driving force.
Right.
And then I do that, and then I say, all right, I want to push this out to my, like, whoever's the schools in my state, and I take that version and I put it back in Flat World, so right. anybody else who might want that goal has that as well.
Exactly.
Where's the money?
Well, it's in how students choose to consume the text. So,
because they pay for it privately?
We're in higher ed, so yeah. Interesting. To be more specific, we're in higher education, so districts don't order textbooks
right.
on behalf of students.
Okay.
But you had another question within there. About changing your book
right.
and then pushing it back up.
No. I didn't. No.
Okay.
So you've got, but what if you said, I mean, because it's still kind of in the traditional model of you get the initial author, right, to put together a text in the same way that other publishing companies would get an author to put together a text. What if I said, I want to write, like, the first parts of the chapters and then put that up, right? That's a little bit, taking, you know, like, so if, again, now I'm a university, right, mm-hmm. and I want my students to take it and add the initial chapters and put it on. Does that work?
Well, that's kind of the next step, is pushing stuff in live beta. But for right now, what users from open books seem to want are easily adoptable complete texts.
Okay.
So that's sort of the phase one that we're in, because, you know, other open models like Connections and Rollo have those fragments of text, but they can be hard to search and hard to aggregate, and people aren't always the best content stewards of their own content, so they don't necessarily fill in who the audience for their book is supposed to be. So right now we try to create the most easily adoptable product possible.
So they might throw it back, and then you go through and kind of say, all right, here's your audience, and right. here's the index that might not be completely filled out for the text, that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, the index is automatically generated, but the idea would be that, okay, so let's say that Scott is a political scientist.
Mm-hmm.
We have an intro political science book. His area of expertise is campaigns and elections. We create the book that's the most adoptable so he can go in and tweak it to his area of expertise.
Okay. And then he...
Am I teaching a course or offering a course?
Sure.
So then you say, you put it... Oh, okay, so then you say to your students, this is the book
mm-hmm.
that
book.
I've tweaked for
my edition of
right.
such and
Scott
such.
Scott edition.
And you push it back up onto Flat World.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting model.
How widely adopted is this by...
What's the market penetration?
Higher, yeah. What's the market penetration? I just want to know.
I don't have the most recent statistics for you, but I think it's 3,000 classrooms. So as an addendum to the podcast, we can throw up the most recent Flat World adoption data.
Okay.
I was thinking that we should also put up Ziga just in case want to know what we're talking about instead of us saying stuff.
I don't want to tell anybody anything.
I know that we're...
I want learners to figure their own things out.
Outstanding illustrators of everything verbal and audio-based.
So... Okay, so maybe...
Can we talk about collaborative storytelling in Ziga?
I would love to talk about collaborative storytelling in Ziga. I know you had some ideas about that. So what are they?
Vanessa's nodding enthusiastically.
Yeah. Great for an audio show.
Yeah.
originally, we weren't going to talk about Flat World for the whole podcast.
You guys had a plan? That's totally against our ethical code and system. We don't have plans.
Originally, when I asked Zach if I could come on the podcast, I thought we would go see the Ziga presentation and brainstorm about ways to use it, and then we could come back and talk about a way, like an actual plan that we could do with this thing. Ziga specifically asked for text-based examples that like help doing that, and since they excel in presenting data as layers, I was thinking about how can we tell a story in layers using multiple points of view.
Well, I think I was thinking of kind of having it as a time signature, right, and that it's going. And so we're telling, like, the key events are up there. So maybe the four of us all record individually, here's the story of the thing that happened to the four of us. And we throw that up there in a collection. And then whoever wants to be the curator of that, not necessarily any of the four of us, then says, I'm going to play Zach's audio up until this event. Then I'm going to play Scott's audio to this event. And then Vanessa, and then Paul, and then maybe going back and forth from different voices, right? So it's all of us telling the story, but as the perspective changes, so you've got, you're blending and kind of, it's almost a mashup of all of these things kind of braided together into one story. I thought that could be interesting.
So you were thinking more sound.
I was thinking sound, and then there would be images kind of the events. I don't know if that works or not, but I tend to think
one of the interesting things, like, that even in the way that you're talking about it is being implied here, is that it's not, like, if we were going to use your example of four people telling stories from various perspectives, whatever theirs happens to be, but they're telling the story about the same event, it doesn't have to be one person. Like, the way I would find it really interesting is you go kind of in time. Really good for an audio show. Now I'm using my hands, waving around.
It's like your bell curve from episode one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, like, you go from the beginning to minute three, and then you're switching perspectives, but instead of going from minute three to minute six, you're going from, like, minute two and a half to minute six. You know what I mean? So there's overlap, and, you know, because you're talking about, like, you use the word
graded. You're still doing audio?
Yeah, doing audio. But you're probably, in essence, really not overlapping the voices, actually.
Okay.
But you are overlapping the sequence of events, the way it was, perceived by the different people.
Right.
Right? And that gives an amount of, I would imagine that it would put in some contrast the differing perspectives.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, it's just essentially one person telling the story the whole time.
Right.
It just happens to be different people telling the story at different times.
And what could also be interesting, because one of the things that we saw in the demo was the ability to overlay still image with movie. And so maybe you've got just a kind of a documentary style image, or like movie of what happened. But then the individual user gets to put up the key images that they think, right? And so then I've said, you get to see what actually happened, but then it's also highlighting the images that people thought were the most important, which then, to take it back, is totally standards, because you're talking about main idea and supporting details and perspective and all of those things, which totally have a place in the classroom. Because everything I go to, I'm thinking, oh, how could a teacher use this in the classroom?
That sounds, Zach, you know, just from, you know, them showing their code today, that sounds totally doable. We make it, you know, a series of events and non-clicks, and we record that audio, and okay, let's make that.
That would be interesting. What events would we choose?
Well, yeah, like, but, and then
I mean, would we make them, like, fictional accounts versus real accounts?
Right. And I think that would be interesting, too, is if you wrote a fictional story, we filmed the fictional story, but I was the one who curated the story, so it wasn't yours anymore, and it was mine.
Right.
And so then there's a really rich conversation about what happened, and what did you mean, and intent of what events are
an interesting, like, literature, introduction to literature unit could be had.
Right.
This could be our project for
Digital Humanities.
DH 2.0.
Or XP Crit.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking about it from an autobiographical perspective, too, because that's You know, there's sort of like certain pivotal events that we all have in development, and like three or four different perspectives on the same life event that everybody has.
On the
has.
Same life event.
Yeah.
Well, and because they were talking today about Mapbox.com, which was a really kind of cool site. I don't know if I can use it for free, though, can I? Do I have to pay?
I think they did say pricing on the homepage.
Paying for things that people make. but I think in like a map overlay, and that could be really interesting. Mm-hmm. Again, though, with students, that would be brilliant to like kind of tell your story, even if it's just you zoom in on your neighborhood. And I know that there are different pieces of Google Earth and Google Maps that allow kids to do this now, but to be able to do it in one space and build something that you can play and that you can preview would be really interesting. There's also a collage feature to it that I liked a lot. Just the overlay, the layering of the story was a little intense, and I liked that a bunch. Yeah, that was really cool. I'm gonna drink my coffee now. go ahead.
So what's unfortunate about this is that I wasn't there to hear them talk. And to meet the people who put this together, I've only really seen their little bits of their creative output. And thus I'm going to push the conversation in a new direction.
Thanks for the announcement.
Well, you're pushing. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Because I've listened to the first couple podcasts.
Yeah.
And there's this thing of like, when the first cup of coffee is done, it's over.
Right.
But I don't think it's abrupt enough.
You need us to just stop when we get done?
Just stop. And I'm done. No more talking.
I think there needs to be a little bit more of a game aspect to it. Because you've always, every time, it's like, hey, I'm almost done with my coffee, so we should wrap this up. It should just be like, you could be in the middle, and somebody would be like, done.
And scene.
And scene.
From the narrative perspective, that could be a little dicey.
Right. We could really piss off the guests. We could let them get to a really fun space where they're really excited about whatever.
Just save one sip of coffee and then be like, that's good.
I'm glad you shared.
We're gonna have to wrap up now. All right, Paul, take it into an advisement.
Yeah.
And just you're the boss, and I just feel like if that's gonna be the whole idea.
The whole shtick. Right. No, I understand.
Go for it. Sorry.
That was a helpful.
I dare you to start something now after Paul vamped for you. So go ahead. Take us in a new direction.
Well, so what am I going to talk about now? I was all excited about what I was saying, and then I forgot what it was because I got to thinking about narrative structure of podcasts. I kind of want to have a conversation about the UDL issue because I think it's really fascinating. UDL being Universal Design for Learning. Partially because I have significant personal problems with not UDL as a concept or even the way the course is being taught. I just have these ways that I imagine that it's almost unscalable. Even though I think UDL is so important.
I'm going to stop for a second.
Yeah.
I want to just talk about scale. Because it is a word that everybody uses all the time.
Right.
And that only ideas that are scalable seem to be those that have validity
plus
in our
one.
World. Is that you agreeing in Google Plus? One of my professors was talking the other day, and we were talking about a case study of social entrepreneurship, and somebody was saying, and we were talking about how the problem was solved and how community resources were used and all this other stuff, and then somebody from the back of the room said, but how would you scale that? Mm-hmm. And the professor's response was, just focus on whether or not you solve the problem you are trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And if it needs to be scaled, then it will scale itself. Mm-hmm. And it was this moment of, I didn't realize I was waiting for someone to give me permission on that level, of like, you're right, it doesn't need to be. Like, if we just look at it as coming up with stuff and or solving a problem, maybe it doesn't matter if I scale the thing. And there's almost a vanity to scaling something that I'm not a big fan of. Like,
I actually think you're right, Zach. It's like this argument. It's an argument that takes the legs out from under any idea. Like, how does it scale? You know, why don't we just...
Well, I'm going to push on that. And by push on
that... Damn the pushing!
By push on that, I really just mean I'm going to talk about the fact that I think that Like, first of all, I never said that something not being scalable delegitimizes it.
Right. I'm just saying
UDL is not scalable, period. Period.
Okay,
it's just not.
Wait.
But that doesn't delegitimize it.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Okay, can you just disagree?
No.
Because either way, someone is going to give birth to a baby if you're pushing so much.
I disagree, because what David Rose is asking us to do is he's asking every individual person who teaches other people to consider learning styles. So if he wins one person over in considering learning styles, like, that is a win. He doesn't, he need to do it from like a top-down level? I mean, sure, there are efforts that are need to be, accomplished from that way, but he's getting individual teachers to think about styles, and that's...
Right, but
that's scalable.
But that is entirely different. Well, maybe not entirely, but it is significantly different than the tools that Cast is using that he's promoting. Like, because what, I mean, like, I entirely agree, like, philosophically. And ultimately, I think that the job of David Rose, that he's doing really well, is to do that and get people to think about alternative learning styles, as are other people. Tina Grotzer is a great example. Duckworth, another example. He is, as part of the UDL structure, not even David Rose, just as part of the UDL structure of the course, mm-hmm. They're introducing... at the very least for demo purposes, and this is confusing to me as a student in the course, materials that they've produced. Not necessarily physical, but like actual applications that they've produced. I think on a theoretical level, you can do just about, you can build in all the options that you can in those like UDL Book Builder applications for speech-to-text and all sort of coaching and all sorts of different things, and you're still not technically going to address the population of students, because the population is theoretically infinite. So I have no problem making the statement, this is not quote-unquote scalable because the theoretical population of students and therefore the theoretical population of learning styles is infinite, because it is, right? I don't have a problem with that, but if we're going to, I would feel more secure as an individual, just my own style, having that statement made and to say, by the way, we're going to talk a lot about the variety, the variance in learning styles, but be aware that there are things that we're not talking about here, and as you consider your instructional design, consider that you are vastly limited. Knowing that, we can move forward. Instead of trying to promote an idea that says, we're gonna talk about learning, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, as the population of learning styles, and then we're gonna address that, because I don't think that's possible.
So let me ask you a question then. What's the worst outcome of you making that statement? What is the potential danger in saying what you just said you'd like somebody to say?
The potential danger of saying we can't necessarily address every style.
Yeah.
If you were being really, really pessimistic, you would say, well, if we can't address every learner, then we shouldn't address any, I suppose.
Okay.
Or something akin to that.
Okay.
If we can't address every learner, Why try to address a variety, perhaps, and like we should just address the major biggest percentage or
okay.
something. I suppose that would be the worst thing.
So does the payoff of not saying that outweigh the danger of people's minds going to that place?
I think that the way that it's done is probably the best way, theoretically. That doesn't make me comfortable with it personally. Like the acknowledgement that I think I'm trying to make as a student and an intellectual and as a person is that the way that I feel, my discomfort with a particular pedagogical style or anything of that nature has nothing to do with whether that's right or wrong. It has to do with my philosophical leanings on this. In my mind, I think UDL is a very important and necessary thing for educators to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
I also have personal significant qualms about saying that, having worked with kids with special needs in my background, like, obviously there's a variety of learning styles. And I have significant problems with the way that we implement things, and I think UDL would go a long way towards alleviating a lot of the problems in modern special ed classrooms. But as a person, as a thinking individual, I'm not comfortable with the suggestion that each person's like learning style could ever be that every learning style could ever be sufficiently summarized and then addressed.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is this objection, it sounds to me like an objection completely based on the model of education that takes place in a classroom with a teacher. Is that true? Am I hearing you right?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer your question.
So, like, it seems to me that your objection is no teacher with a single tool, could take care of the variety of people who might be in front of them.
False.
Oh, okay.
The reason for that is that, I mean, theoretically, a classroom has a finite group of students. So I think my objection, you know what I'm saying? So theoretically, there could be a tool, but if the classroom's 30 kids, there could be a tool that addresses every single one of the specific needs for a specific curriculum as, you know, delineated either by the student or the parents or the district or lawyers or doctors or whomever. So theoretically, there could be a tool that works in that classroom. But the population is theoretically infinite.
Okay.
This is like a statistical principle that I'm applying here.
So let me ask it a different way. And I think this is similar to what you were saying, which is, when we talk about scalability,
yeah.
And this is my problem with scalability as it's used around here all the time, is
yeah.
that people want to scale the model, or they want to scale the tool, or
mm-hmm.
they want to scale blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
But we should be trying to scale the idea, the way of going about solving the problem, or thinking, so the thing that is scalable is the idea that each problem is unique.
Mm-hmm.
If you can bring that idea to scale,
uh-huh.
then we have a different way of approaching problems.
Certainly
that is
true.
A fantastic place to end the podcast, because I have finished my cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So while I vamp a little bit, everyone will think of the thing that they want to say they learned this week, and then they will say the thing that they learned this week. So does anybody have their thing yet? No? Not yet?
No.
I do.
Okay, go ahead. What'd you learn this week, Vanessa?
This week, I learned how to make and edit video.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
What'd you use?
iMovie.
Cool.
This week, I learned, let's see, what did I learn? I learned a lot of stuff this week. Today was a crazy day in class. We talked about concept ecology in Tina Grotzer, and so I learned about concept ecology. Could I explain it to you? No.
No. So still processing.
So still processing.
All right.
Certainly.
People just went to Wikipedia.
Hopefully it's there.
Hopefully they were not driving.
Well, I Wikipedia'd ecology in order to.
Oh, that's a start.
To learn about concept ecology as a kind of idea.
One would hope they're related.
In some ways, yes.
In others, no.
No.
All right. Well, look that up, Paul.
I learned a little bit about how HTML works.
Okay.
Yay!
And mine is similar to that. I learned last night that if you are trying to build code in text edit on a Mac and then you export it as an HTML, there are still little bits of formatting there somewhere in the background that make it not function the way it should.
change it to plain.
I tried that.
Didn't work.
Oh god, it was an unbearable nightmare.
Oh god, that's terrible.
So you have just wasted another cup of coffee with all of us. So thank you, Vanessa, for coming and joining.
Yes, thank you so much.
And thank you, Paul, for lurking. Really good job.
Nice
really
chair.
Nicely done.
It was excellent.
So thanks a lot. Have a nice week.
I'm Scott.
I'm Zach.
This is Learning Ground.
Bye.
Go!
Thank you for listening to Learning Grounds with Scott and Zach. Our intro music comes from New Dance Boys Mission. It's called Intro, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Learning Grounds is also under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Say it three times fast. And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.